It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Kirk O'Bare will be with us next week. We start off with the Oscar Pistorius trial. They closed their case recently in the Oscar Pistorius trial, and now both sides have adjourned to allow them to prepare written legal arguments on the case. Of course, Oscar Pistorius, Blade Runner, who is accused of the murder of his model girlfriend Reva Steenkamp, and the entire issue in the case is whether he reasonably feared for his safety. In other words, whether he thought Reva Steenkamp was an intruder in his own home and he shot behind the bathroom door, or whether they got in a lover's quarrel, as the prosecution calls it, and he intended to murder Reva Steenkamp. And, of course, the judge will decide this. And in South African law, it's the judge and two assessors, that's what they call them, two people who essentially help the judge decide whether somebody is guilty or not guilty. And throughout this entire trial, we've seen all kinds of emotion from Oscar Pistorius. We've seen him cry. We've seen the prosecutor get very, very aggressive in terms of cross-examination. We've heard psychologist reports who've reported on the tragic life of Oscar Pistorius, the fact that he lost two limbs, the fact that he apparently suffered a lot as a child, and there was a psychologist report to the court that said that Pistorius is depressed, has a sleep disorder, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And so there's all kinds of things coming into play. Now, whether you believe Oscar Pistorius's story or not, this is a very interesting trial with lots of different facets. So now the prosecution has until July 30th to submit their written legal arguments, closing arguments. And then after that, the defense must submit its arguments by August 4th, and the court will then resume August 7th for both sides to present closing oral arguments to the court. And if Pistorius is convicted of this, he faces potentially life in prison. If he's convicted of culpable homicide or a lesser version, not intentional homicide, then the penalty is up to the discretion of the court. So a lot of things that we've seen in the Oscar Pistorius case, I think it really comes down to these neighbors that say that they heard a woman screaming before what they believed were shots fired. In other words, they're suggesting that Pistorius knew who he was shooting because they heard a woman screaming. And the defense brought in an audio expert that said, no, this wasn't a woman screaming. This was, in fact, Oscar Pistorius screaming. And, you know, his pitch, his tone is different when he, in fact, is screaming. So that's a major point of contention in this entire thing. Another neighbor heard a man and a woman arguing, they said, for about an hour before there was a sound of four loud bangs. So again, that goes to the prosecution's theory that this was a lover's quarrel and this was some type of planned murder in this case. They even went so far as to say that Reva Steenkamp had food in her stomach at the time of the autopsy, suggesting that she ate within 2 hours of her death at 3 a.m. And the reason this is important in the case is because Oscar Pistorius said that they went to bed at 10 p.m., which would have been about 5 hours before she died. And Oscar Pistorius's character has been really on trial in this. They've described Oscar Pistorius as an angry man, even brought in one of his ex-girlfriends to talk about that. On the other side, Oscar Pistorius, and I think things that might go, obviously, in Oscar Pistorius' favor, are that there was testimony that he had a heightened sense of fear of intruders. And why is that? Because his family had been victims of crime many times before. And the suggestion was that he reacted more dramatically to threats. And that he felt very vulnerable because he didn't have his prosthetic legs when he fired the shots. And if you recall, that was one of the big things that the prosecution played up, is that essentially at the beginning they said, well, he did have his prosthetic legs on, meaning, you know, you can't really use the excuse that you didn't have them on and you felt threatened. Well, it turns out that the prosecution essentially had to concede throughout this trial that Oscar Pistorius did not have his prosthetic legs on when he fired the shots. And this was based on the trajectory of the bullets through the bathroom door and all kinds of other things. But a psychologist came in and testified that Oscar Pistorius' reaction might seem extraordinary for a regular person, for somebody who doesn't have two legs missing. But that in Oscar Pistorius' case, his height, his sense of fight or flight is very much more heightened than the average person, and that he has generalized anxiety disorder, and that he was distressed by what happened. So it comes down to all kinds of different evidence in this case. And really, the screaming is the major thing. So I don't know what's going to happen in this particular instance, but it really does show you all of the things that can come into a trial. And one thing that I am often disturbed by is that people do prejudge in our society, although I understand it because it's human nature. I mean, when a lot of people heard about this Oscar Pistorius being charged with murder, they believed he must be guilty. And who knows? Maybe the judge will find him guilty. Maybe the judge will find him not guilty. But the bottom line is, as you delve more and more into this case, you sort of start to realize that, you know, this isn't as cut and dried as you might think it would be. It seems to me that there are lots of mitigating factors and aggravating factors on both sides, and that this is a relatively close case. It's certainly a tragic case. There's no doubt about it. But it's a relatively close case. And we often judge, especially when we see all these things in the media, all these things on television and on the internet, where they post mugshots of people and they post pictures of people at their most vulnerable state. Well, Oscar Pistorius was certainly in his most vulnerable state. Whether you think he's a good guy or a bad guy, he was very, very emotional throughout this entire thing. He was crying. You could see that he was distraught. And I really think it's hard to make that up. I mean, I don't think you'd have to be pretty skilled if you were going to make up the fact that you were crying, especially in the manner that he was. Now, maybe he's distraught because he got caught. You could argue that. Maybe he's distraught because he's innocent, because he did feel that there was an intruder coming in. You could argue that as well. But to judge somebody, I mean, this is a prime example of why we have a legal process. Now, this is the South African legal process, and it's different than the criminal justice system in the United States, which I think is a wonderful justice system. Certainly, it has its flaws, and we need to do what we can to fix it or to improve upon it each day. But it is overall a very, very good system, in my opinion. And so we have to let that system play out. It can't just be somebody was arrested, they were charged with a crime, and therefore we're going to presume them guilty. We know a jury can't do that, and a jury is not supposed to do that, and that's not what the law says. But I'll give you a prime example. I have a gentleman who I work with on a regular basis who came in, and when I first met him, he had a Chicago Bears jersey on, of all things. And I immediately snapped and made a judgment about that person. I thought, he's a Bears fan. Hey, how good can he be? He's a Bears fan. I grew up in Wisconsin, love Wisconsin, a Packers fan, Brewers fan, Badgers fan, all of it. This is obviously a different example than in the criminal justice system, but I drew a judgment about him. I made a judgment. We all make judgments in everyday life. But when it comes to the criminal justice system, we have to try to do that. And I could say, as I got to know this person who I work with on a regular basis, he's a great guy. He's one of the best guys I know. He's a wonderful person. And so to go in and judge people on that level is an easy thing to do because it's human nature, because we have to do it, we have to react, we have to analyze people in split seconds. But that's not what our justice system is about. Our justice system says you must prove somebody guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Otherwise, they are innocent unless and until proven guilty, proven otherwise, beyond all reasonable doubt. And so when you think about people like Oscar Pistorius, he may be convicted, he may not be convicted. But there's a lot on the line for him. There's a lot on the line certainly for Reeva Steenkamp's family, and you must feel awful for Reeva Steenkamp's family. She was, by all accounts, a very, very good woman and somebody who didn't deserve to die. But in this case, the defense is not that Oscar Pistorius didn't shoot her. Both sides concede that he shot her. The issue is whether he did it in self-defense, whether he believed it was an intruder, or whether he believed or whether he had planned this in some type of lover's quarrel. So we'll follow this story, of course, on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
She's a good girl, loves her mama, loves Jesus in America too. She's a good girl, is crazy about Elvis, loves horses and her boyfriend too. It's a long day living in Reseda. There's a freeway running through the yard, and I'm a bad boy, 'cause I don't even miss her. I'm a bad boy for breaking her heart.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. And this story about the Acuity flag, well, this is a big flag. And if you live in Sheboygan County, or even if you don't, you've driven down I-43 past the Acuity insurance building, you've seen the nation's tallest flagpole, which is right in Sheboygan, a 140-foot high flagpole. Very high flagpole. And there was something that happened just this past week. And there was a young man, who apparently decided to jump off of the nation's tallest flagpole. Bungee jump, I mean. Essentially, that's what he did. And posted this video on YouTube, which ended up getting him in some trouble. Now, he did this actually on the 4th of July. And he said, "I'm Nick Propson, and we've come to the land of the world's largest flag on the 4th of July to wish America a happy birthday, the greatest country in the world." And in this video, for all to see on YouTube, he described the height. He said, "I'm terrified to death, ain't gonna lie." Then he said, "God bless America, God bless our troops." So he was tethered to this crane by a rope or bungee cord, or bungee-like cord, something like that. And he jumps. And as he's jumping, Tom Petty's song Free Fallin' starts playing on the video. And, you know, it seems like a fairly, a situation where he's trying to be patriotic. He's doing something on the 4th of July. That being said, it's certainly dangerous. It's certainly very dangerous. And especially when you're doing this without, you don't have somebody who's certified. There's lots of people who bungee jump, but you have to take a lot of precautions when you are doing this type of thing because it can be so dangerous. And I read something, I don't know if this is true, about how the 140-foot drop that he came about 5 feet from the ground. I don't know if that's true or not. But that's pretty close. And apparently this particular individual has made a hobby of jumping off of tall buildings or tall places, I should say, in Wisconsin, and then posting video of those jumps. So he has been cited for trespassing on a construction site at Acuity, and it's being reported that somebody at Acuity reported this jump, and also that this same particular individual was cited last summer in Green Bay for jumping off of a bridge in Green Bay. So he has some type of a pattern of doing this type of thing. And we've talked before about people in New York City jumping off of buildings or, you know, bungee jumping, doing things like that. And it can be very dangerous. But this goes to show, really, whether you think this is right or whether it's wrong. I'm sure that some view it as a harmless prank, as something that could be viewed as patriotic because he was, you know, he had the American flag. He was talking about our troops. He was talking about how much he loves the country. It was on the 4th of July. And so he jumped off of this building. Others view it as, hey, this is not a good situation. This is something that he should not have done. And it's dangerous. And so he should be cited for it. That's the view of other people. But my understanding is now the prosecutors are deciding what to charge him with or whether they can charge him with something more than trespassing and whether they will. And the argument could be made, well, he wasn't endangering anybody else's life. He was endangering perhaps his own life, but not anybody else's. And so what's the harm here? And it's a big debate that goes on. And I'm sure, or I should say, I would suspect that he's a little bit upset that he posted this on YouTube. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's proud of it. Maybe he likes it. But posting it on YouTube is a surefire way to get some type of reaction because then anybody can view it. And this is the issue of social media in our day and age. According to another story, this same person also mentioned on his Facebook page on June 7th that the Sheboygan Police Department was trying to reach him. And you better believe that the Sheboygan Police Department or any other police department, they obviously know about Facebook. I'm sure there are ways that they can access somebody's Facebook page, especially if it's made public for all to see. And so I don't know whether this man was trying to get attention or that he just didn't care or he didn't know. But there are lots of organizations out there and agencies using Facebook, using social media to help try to solve crimes or solve situations or find out who's responsible for things. And the plethora of information that is posted on Facebook and other social media sites, I'm always surprised by it, and I shouldn't be anymore, because you can find so much out about a person from that page. It's a wealth of information. It's a plethora of information. And now he's got a big issue because he's been cited. The Green Bay Press Gazette has a very cool story called Ex-Con Goes from Time Served to Serving Others. And it's a story about Peter Golowski. And he says there are dates that he never forgets. And he is a Green Bay resident who turns 63 years old on July 23rd. And the story says he's been out of prison for 8.5 years. He has no desire, let alone no intention, to go behind bars again after living that confined existence for 28 years. A convicted murderer who credits his delayed faith in Jesus for the release from prison that wasn't supposed to happen is helping others who have been incarcerated open their eyes. The potential for salvation exists outside the jailhouse or prison walls. He says, "Now I'm a giver. The reason I'm a giver is because of God's love. He forgave me much, so much I love, and because of that, my heart's desire is to look at others, not just at myself." The former longtime inmate has devoted many hours during his newfound freedom the last several years to prison ministry. He's active in the Prison Aftercare Network of Northeast Wisconsin. The local network includes several faith-based ministries and organizations that provide information, resources, and support for men and women who have been in prison with their families. And the goal, essentially, is to reacclimate people to life. So this is something that I think is a wonderful story for various different reasons, not the least of which is that you have a convicted murderer who apparently has helped so many people, who has, you know, certainly committed a terrible crime and something that is one of the worst in society. And after living 28 years confined in prison, he's reformed himself. And that's really the point of our justice system. That's the point of our Department of Corrections, not our Department of Punishment and Retribution, but our Department of Corrections, to correct the behavior, to help somebody reacclimate to everyday life, to help somebody come back out. Because if they're going to come back out, if we're not going to lock them up forever, then they're going to come back out into society. And if they're going to come back out into society, we as society have an interest in making sure that they don't go back into prison, that they don't commit another crime, that they become productive members of society. And a lot of people might have thrown this guy away. They might have said, oh, he's convicted murderer. Forget about him. He's trash. Let's just let him go on his way. Let him rot in prison. That's the attitude of some people. Others who say, this person has a chance. And although they've committed a horrendous crime, they have a chance to reform themselves. And he spent a lot of time in prison. He served his time. He paid his debt to society, and now he's giving back. So what happened? Why do we have the Peter Golowskis out there who are doing this and others who are not? There's a lot more people than you might think in the criminal justice system who are doing wonderful things with their lives after they get themselves into trouble for whatever reason. And one of the reasons that they get themselves into trouble is because of drug and alcohol addiction. It's a major issue in our criminal justice system. It's something that really needs to be addressed even more than it is right now. And a lot of times we've got wonderful resources out there who and people who are addressing this issue, who recognize the issue, and who recognize that if we get that type of thing under control, which by my own estimation probably comprises about 90% of the people that I see, well, then we save a lot of people, and we save a lot of heartache, and we save a lot of taxpayer resources, and we help keep families together. And we do a lot of things that society wants to do, or at least should want to do, because they're better for us all. Making our communities safer, keeping families together. Those are things I think that we can all agree on. And this is just one story, one example of some good that can come out of a horrible, horrible situation and a horrible act. I'm Casey Hoff. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it, New York, New York.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Kirk O'Bear will be back with us next week. A New York fraternity at a New York City college is under a lot of hot water. This from the Pocono Record writer. Police plan to charge most of the 30 fraternity members who took part in a retreat where a New York City college freshman died in December. Pocono Mountain Regional Police Chief Harry Lewis was quoted in a story in the New York Times as saying that the charges will include criminal homicide, a felony, and hazing, a misdemeanor. The freshman died December 9th. The death was ruled a homicide. The cause of death was determined to be a massive brain trauma. Police say that he hit his head during a hazing ritual at a home rented by a fraternity that he was pledging to join. They plan to file charges against members of the Pi Delta Psi fraternity in May. But he said that authorities are still awaiting two pieces of evidence key to the case, an unspecified medical report and a digital animation that portrays the events leading to this young man's death. Contacted on this past Monday, Lewis confirmed that he was awaiting the reports, but when they might be done was not available. According to court documents, the young man died on December 9th, one day after he fell and hit his head during a fraternity hazing ritual. Police said that the ritual involved pledges, blindfolded and carrying weighted backpacks, running through a gauntlet of fraternity members attempting to tackle them. They said that the young man was pushed and fell backwards, striking his head on the ground. And instead of seeking medical attention, according to police, the fraternity members who brought the young man who was unconscious into the house that they had rented for the retreat. They reportedly researched head injuries online before taking him to a hospital. According to police, they were able to retrieve every video, photo, content, and conversation from the fraternity members' cell phones, despite their efforts to conceal them. Police also say that three men from the fraternity drove the young man to the hospital and misled investigators about how the injury had happened. And this is really what's getting them in the most amount of trouble. So these homicide charges are ranging anywhere from involuntary manslaughter to premeditated murder. This all happened when the fraternity was on a retreat in Pennsylvania. And this is some type of ritual. And there are many states that have laws that actually prohibit hazing, at least in this type of situation, certainly, where there's some type of abuse that's going on, or at least that appears to be going on. So what is the defense in this case? Well, I don't know. And first of all, as we talked about earlier, prejudging these fraternity members this early on, I think is wrong, and we need to let the system play it out. They might be guilty, they might not be guilty. But the bottom line is, hazing is a big issue. Because even if it wasn't some type of intentional murder, in other words, if this was an accident, it's a horrible accident. It's something that shouldn't be, should never be repeated. This fraternity, I believe, is suspended permanently from this college, and there were some different legal processes that need to happen. But one of the things that the prosecution is trying to do, or at least the police are trying to do in this case, is they're trying to gather up and create an animation to dramatize the events that happened. In other words, to show what police believe to be a ritual. Computer animation is becoming a big deal. You may have noticed it, and it's been a big deal for a long time, but it's becoming even bigger as it gets easier to make computer animations of things. You may remember the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin trial. And there was an animation that the defense created in that case to dramatize the events of that fatal encounter and what happened. Mr. Zimmerman was acquitted. And I think the real reason that computer animations are so popular is because the jury can see what you're doing. It's not just words. It's not just somebody saying something. It's not just testimony. We are a visual society. If you think about the amount of people who watch television every day, who look at the internet, we see things. And I think that's how we learn, how at least many in society learn, is by viewing things. Because we're bombarded with images on a daily basis. Less and less people read. I would argue that's not a good thing for society. I think more people should be reading. But the fact remains, less and less people are reading. More and more people are looking at things online. They're watching television because of the readily available access to all of this media. And so when you could really put it in front of somebody and create an animation that portrays the events of that day so that the jury can actually see it, that can be a powerful thing for the prosecution. It can be a powerful thing for the defense. But one thing that you need to be very careful of, or that lawyers need to be very careful of, in my opinion, is to make sure that that dramatization, that reenactment, that animation is consistent with the facts that are in evidence, is consistent with what actually happened, matches up with what actually happened. Because if it doesn't, then the other side is going to have a field day with that, because they're going to say that you're creating something that's fictional, that doesn't actually represent what happened. So that's very important. And I think we'll see more computer animation as we go forward. Well, in Georgia, there's a controversial case going on, and I'm sure you've all heard about the case of Justin Ross Harris of Georgia, who's being held without bond on charges of felony murder and second-degree cruelty to children after he left his young son, Cooper, in a hot car where the son ended up dying. It's a 33-year-old man who has this child, and the whole debate, you know, originally when this came out, there was lots of sympathy. There were lots of people talking about how this parent made a mistake and he didn't mean to leave his child in the car. And so now that he's being punished and charged with felony murder, it's a very serious situation. And there were lots of people who had sympathy for him. Now, I think the public opinion and the tide has shifted on that as more and more evidence comes out. Because in this particular case, the police, and one of the things that we commented on at the very beginning of this was how the police had gotten a search warrant to basically search this man's computer at work, because the story goes that he went to work, and before going to work, he stopped for breakfast with his son. He parked, then went to work, and left his kid in the back of the car. Now, whether you believe he truly forgot the kid or whether he did this on purpose and left the kid in a hot car to perish is another question. So then why did they go in and try to get his computer records? Well, because, according to police, they found on his computer records searches relating to how long children survive in hot cars. And the timing of that search, the timing of when that occurred, is going to be very, very important in this case. Because so far as we can tell, Justin Ross Harris's attorney says that there was essentially an initiative by the governor to put out a PSA on, you know, not leaving your kid in a hot car. And according to the defense, this was the wife's worst fear. And the husband and wife both did not ever want that to happen. And so they were researching that. So you can see how the timing of this comes into play. Because if they were researching that at the very time that the son was in the car and was dying in the car, well, that looks very suspicious. If, on the other hand, it's at a different time, you may be able to make a plausible argument for that. But there's more to the story than that. There are lots of different tweets on Twitter that are going on. Again, the use of social media. And really, it's coming down to a lot of Harris's character. They're talking about how he met other women. They're questioning whether he was happy in his marriage. And even his wife is becoming a target, it seems. Although she's not currently, at least to my knowledge, named as a co-conspirator in this death, his wife has had lots of different, I guess you could say, unusual reactions. Now, it's important to point out that everybody reacts differently to different situations. And I'll give you an example. Somebody who's just suffered the loss of a loved one, some people may cry, some people may get hysterical. Others may not. Others may be in shock. Others may not exhibit at least outward emotion. And so we have to be careful about how we judge people who are grieving the loss of a child. But in the mother's case, there's more to it than that. She's answered questions, at least according to police, that are odd. And in her interactions with her husband, who's in jail, they're no longer allowing her to see her husband in jail because of some of the communications that they've been having and what police are calling essentially suspicious behavior. And their marriage is coming into play. And I think the reason that their marriage is coming into play is because there's all these allegations that the father was involved with sending explicit text messages to other women and was perhaps unhappy in his marriage. Now, he and his wife deny that, and they say that's not true. But this is why they're going into this, because they're saying, you know, look, what it's framing up to be and what it's shaping up to be, at least from the prosecution's point of view, seems to be, hey, this was a guy who was unhappy in his marriage. He didn't like being in his marriage. He was sexting other women. He wanted to get out of the marriage. And one thing that keeping him from doing that was the fact that he had a young child that he had responsibility for, and he wanted to end that child's life. On the defense side, they're saying this is all not true, and that in fact what Justin Harris was doing on the side of the road is grieving the loss of his son, and he didn't know that his son was in the car. The biggest issue in this case that I see are the text, or excuse me, the internet searches. If police have those internet searches, and if they can link them up to Justin Ross Harris, and if they can show that they were happening around the same time, that's going to be a big hurdle to get over for the defense. But we'll follow this story and much more as we continue right after this with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Well, a Cedarburg man has won his money back from an RV that was seized from his RV years ago in Nebraska, back in 2009, in fact. And this story was from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. If you're a young person traveling across Nebraska, be careful how much money you carry. A driver from Cedarburg who got pulled over in 2009 near Lincoln, Nebraska, lost $48,100 after state troopers there seized it as suspected drug money. But a federal court, appeals court now says the government had no real grounds to keep the cash. Their only evidence was theoretical and conjectural, said Patrick Brennan, the Milwaukee attorney who argued for the money's return. He was unsuccessful at a 2012 trial before prevailing on appeal on Friday, this past Friday, not this one, when the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed a lower court's decision in the government's favor. The appeals court ordered the money returned, a fairly unusual result when citizens challenge large cash forfeitures. Now, this story gets so interesting because the driver was 22 years old at the time. He was from Cedarburg, and he was headed out to Colorado. And he was headed out to Colorado in his RV, and he was headed out to Colorado in his RV with his two dogs, one of which happened to be a pit bull. And according to the young man, in order to save him the cost of hotels, he decided to carry cash with him. And he had nearly $50,000 in cash that he kept in a safe inside of the RV, in a small safe, along with all of his other important personal papers, because he was planning on setting up residency in the state of Colorado. And he said that the nearly $50,000 in money was the result of selling bonds that his grandmother had given to him and other various different legal sources. And so as he was driving, he got out to Colorado, and the story goes that once he got out to Colorado, he lived in his RV for a while and learned that the local ordinance where he was living said no pit bulls. And it essentially said, if you get caught with a pit bull and we catch you with it, we're going to take it, confiscate your pit bull. And I assume what happens at that point is they put the pit bull down. And being a dog lover, he decided this wasn't for him. He didn't want to live here. And for various different reasons, decided to come back to Cedarburg. And on his way back to Cedarburg, he's passing through Nebraska. And he gets pulled over for a traffic violation, a minor traffic violation, following another vehicle too closely, in fact. And the trooper testified that he was apparently watching this RV because it had Wisconsin license plates and also had a younger driver. The trooper said that Colorado was a known source state for marijuana and that Wisconsin is a known destination state for resale of marijuana. And the trooper, according to the story, says that Nelson seemed nervous and at first he denied having any drugs and would not consent to a search of the RV. Well, I can tell you that when you're pulled over by a police officer, most people, whether they've done something wrong or not, get nervous. Because when you see the red and blue lights go on behind you, most people have had this reaction. They don't like it. They feel nervous, even if they've done nothing wrong. They're wondering why they're being pulled over. And certainly if they have done something wrong, they'd be nervous as well. So I don't think being nervous because you're pulled over by a police officer is necessarily something that would suggest that you've done something wrong. But after the trooper then called for a drug-sniffing dog, after the young man denied consent to search his RV, which he has a constitutional right to deny consent to, then Nelson admitted that he had a small amount of pot, marijuana. So the trooper then searched the RV and found a half ounce of pot. And Nelson was then ticketed for the marijuana. But they also found cash wrapped in bundles inside of a backpack in the RV. And they found other various, minor issues involving drug paraphernalia. So they decided as a result of this that this was connected to drug activity, or they believed that it was connected to drug activity. And as a result, they kept the cash, nearly $50,000 worth of cash. And again, this was after finding 2.7 grams of marijuana, a very small amount, a marijuana grinder and several marijuana-themed magazines, and a plastic bag containing $48,100 in currency. And it should be noted that this man had just been in Colorado, where recreational use of small amounts of marijuana is legal. But, of course, it's not legal in Nebraska, where he was pulled over. So based on this, they take the money. And they also searched this young man's cell phone because they were thinking, as a result, they were going to find drug-related activities on the cell phone. They were going to find in the text messages and in the voicemail recordings on the cell phone. They were going to find some evidence of drug transactions, some evidence of drug dealing or something of that nature going on in the cell phone. Well, they searched the cell phone, and this story doesn't say whether they searched the cell phone with Nelson's consent or not. But lo and behold, they search the cell phone. They find nothing on the cell phone that would indicate that he was involved in drug activity or drug transactions, or that this money, this $50,000, was going to be used to essentially facilitate a drug transaction. There was no evidence of that. So then they had what's called a forfeiture hearing, which is something where you get to challenge and say, hey, government, you took my money. And it wasn't involved in a drug transaction, and you took my money, and it's my money that I got from legal sources, and it's my money that I got from legitimate sources. So both Nelson and his father testified that the currency had come from Nelson's earnings, the sale of bonds, Nelson's stock dividends, and money given to Nelson by his relatives. The government conceded that the currency had all come from legitimate sources, but they said this money should be forfeited anyway because we believe that Nelson had planned to use it to purchase narcotics in an unspecified transaction, which for some unknown reason had not occurred. And that was essentially the argument. Hey, we found all this money. Here it was. We also found a little bit of marijuana and some drug paraphernalia, and we believe that this money was going to be used for a future drug transaction. But they didn't provide any affirmative evidence of the transaction. And in fact, when they searched the cell phone, they found no evidence of it. And one of the things that the officer testified to, he essentially admitted and said, hey, you know, normally in these types of cases, I would find something on a cell phone if this particular individual were involved in drug trafficking. And in the lower court, the judge concluded that it was more likely than not that the $48,100 in cash that was found in bundles in this RV was subject to forfeiture because it was substantially connected to a planned but unconsummated drug transaction. In other words, something that hadn't yet happened, but they believe it was connected to that. And the government has to prove in these hearings the burden. They have the burden of proving that the money is subject to forfeiture by a preponderance of the evidence. So in this type of a hearing, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's by a preponderance of the evidence. And of course, Nelson said, hey, I was traveling out to Denver. My purpose was to return because I was finding it harder to live on my own, and I discovered this local law that could have led to one of my dogs being seized and put down. And so this just goes to show you, and also I should note that this, according to the opinion that was released, this particular young man didn't like banks. He really had a disdain for banks. He didn't like them, and so he carried this money. And I think to myself, you know, I've known especially elderly people, and I remember, you know, certainly people who grew up in the Great Depression and who had that experience or whose parents had that experience, oftentimes they don't trust banks, and they keep money under their mattress. You've heard of that happening. Does that mean they're connected to drug activity? No, even if they had a small amount of marijuana on them at the time. And so the court found that essentially, if a person was to travel with a large sum of money, that it would be common sense to have that person keeping it organized you know, and keeping it in a safe and all of that while they're traveling across the country, especially if they don't like they don't want to stay in a hotel, they want to stay in the RV, they got to have money to survive, and they don't want to keep it at a bank. So it turned out that eventually this money came back. The court also noted that Nelson didn't have any firearms. And the trooper who testified at the hearing said if they had had a firearm, having firearms can go hand in hand with drug trafficking. There were no firearms, no text messages, no voicemail that would suggest that he was engaging in drug trafficking of any kind. And in the end, the Court of Appeals ruled that the government's theory about a planned transaction relies on mere speculation rather than on circumstantial evidence. And in a forfeiture hearing where you're the forfeiture of money, this is a big deal. This is a big win, especially when you come by with this amount of money. And the court even said, well, had there been $100,000, that wouldn't necessarily mean that a person is connected to drug activity. But in this particular case, the money has been ordered to be returned. You've been listening to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. You've been listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a great weekend.